This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm Dave Davies in for Terry Gross. We're going to listen to the interview Terry recently recorded with actor Edward Norton, who co-stars in the new film Birdman. Norton was in the Wes Anderson films The Grand Budapest Hotel and Moonrise Kingdom, and starred in The 25th Hour, Death to Smoochie, Fight Club, and American History X. Norton's character in Birdman is a pretentious, self-absorbed, but very talented and edgy theater actor who's been cast in a play directed by a washed-up movie star played by Michael Keaton. Keaton's character had been famous for portraying a superhero called Birdman. Norton's character has no respect for superhero movies in general, or this actor in particular. In his own condescending way, Norton's trying to teach Keaton what theater acting is really about and how the stage is a place to reveal truth, with the implication that Keaton might have been a star, but he's not a real actor. Birdman is in part about ego, aging, and clashing approaches to acting as Keaton tries to reignite his career and reinvent himself. The film was directed by Alejandro Iñárritu. In this scene, after a botched preview performance, Keaton's character suggests to Norton's that they get a cup of coffee and try to work things out between them. Keaton speaks first.
Let's go. Walk.
Where are we going?
To get you some coffee. Did I do something to disrespect you?
Not yet.
Look, I have a lot riding on this play.
Oh, is that right?
Yeah. People know who I am.
My they don't know you, your work, man. They know the guy from the bird suit who goes and tells coy, slightly vomitous stories on Letterman.
Well, I'm sorry if I'm popular, Mike.
Popular? You know, I don't give a popular. Popularity is this bloody little cousin of prestige, my friend.
Okay, I don't even know what that means, so.
Well, it means my reputation is riding on this, and that's worth
a lot,
exactly.
Right.
Yes, if this doesn't work out for you, you off back to your studio pals and dive back into that cultural genocide you guys are perpetrating. You know, a douchebag's born every minute. That was P.T. Barnum's premise when he invented the circus, and nothing much has changed. And you guys know that if you crank out any toxic piece of crap, people will line up and pay to see it. But long after you're gone, I'm going to be on that stage, earning my living, bearing my soul, wrestling with complex human emotions.
Right.
That's what we do.
Oh, so is that what tonight was about, you wrestling with complex emotions?
Tonight was just about seeing if it's even alive, seeing if it can bleed. No, this isn't a backlot rigging. This is New York City. This is how we do things.
Where are you going?
They have coffee here.
It's a scene from Birdman. Edward Norton, welcome back to Fresh Air. I love the film. there's a couple of scenes where it's basically like one really long shot that follow, you know, actors. In a couple of these scenes, like during this one really long shot, there's people like walking on and off camera, and everything is so perfectly choreographed. Often in films, scenes are very short and highly edited, or there's a long scene, but there's not that much choreography within it. So I'm wondering what's it like for you when you're doing a really long take, and if any one thing in that take is wrong, the whole thing has to start from the beginning again.
Yeah, Alejandro has conceived it as kind of a waking dream, like a seamless floating shot. The entire film moves along without any apparent break or edit, and throughout virtually the entirety of the film. So it's not like one of those films where there's sort of a bravura 7-minute shot within the middle of the film that's sort of a set piece. It's the entire film presents itself as a single, unbroken, seamless movement of the camera. And the amazing thing about Alejandro, I think, is that he said right away, look, there's a reason for doing this, which is I'm telling a story about a person in a spiritual crisis who might actually be losing his mind. He might actually be going crazy. We're not sure. And I don't ever want to leave the bubble of his anxiety. I want the audience with him inside the bubble of his mounting panic and all the things that happened to him without any break, because I want them to experience life in the seamless way that he's experiencing it.
And people pride themselves on being improvisational in movies, but in a scene where everything has to be choreographed and orchestrated in advance because it's one long take, you can't be improvisational. It would throw everything off.
Well, not exactly. I mean, it's funny, but the thing is that you can create once people have gotten, the dance, and it is a dance, it's like a choreography, it's a complex choreography with a lot of people, but once it's been sort of built as a foundation, I think that's the enormous pleasure of working with people like Michael Keaton and Zach Galifianakis and people with like an astonishing ability to, even within a set choreography, sort of do a backflip, you know, that you weren't expecting. And the fun of it was sort of once we got going, realizing that it wasn't going to be magical unless people came up with sort of unrepeatable moments within the context of all that choreography. And it happened a lot. I think there's lots and lots within the film that that is what you would call improvisational. And I think among the many things that makes Emmanuel Lubezki, the cinematographer, like one of the greatest I've ever worked with, is that he was capable of like turning and burying his face in his shoulder because he was laughing at something improvised and never letting go of the camera and losing the shot. He's really like one of the greatest photographers in the history of the trade, I think.
So in Birdman, Michael Keaton plays an actor who is famous as the superhero Birdman. And he declined, 20 years ago, he declined to star in Birdman 4. He was done with the franchise. And then his career has been in decline ever since. People really only know him as Birdman. Now, you were in the 2008 film The Incredible Hulk, and you played the scientist who's transformed by gamma radiation into the Incredible Hulk. It's not what you became famous for, but it did very well at the box office. And is there a level on which you can relate to the story of somebody who was in a superhero movie and became too well known for that?
Not so much. I would say I encounter the large preponderance of people who come up to me with some sort of a strong relationship or reaction to work I've done since, you know, the mid-90s. It's for other things. And I think that doesn't mean I don't find people appreciate it or that I'm not proud of that one. I think it's a lot of fun. I really wanted to make that movie. And I grew up on it too. And I think there's a very mythic element to the Hulk story in particular. But I didn't find it constricting or limiting in the slightest.
You did turn down being in subsequent films. How come? In subsequent Hulk films.
I think that, you know, my feeling was that I experimented and experienced what I wanted to. I really, really enjoyed it. And yet, I looked at the balance of time in life that one spends not only making those sorts of films, but then especially putting them out, and the obligations that rightly come with that. And there were just a lot of things that I wanted more diversity. I sort of chose to continue on my path of having a diversity of experiences. And maybe on some unconscious level, I didn't want to have an association with one thing in any way degrade my effectiveness as an actor in characters. I think you can sort of do anything once, but if you do it too many times, it can become a suit that's hard to take off in other people's eyes. And if I had continued on with it, I wouldn't have made Moonrise Kingdom or Grand Budapest or Birdman, because those all overlapped with and those were more the priority for me. But I totally I continue to be a fan, and I'm really, really happy I got to do it once. That particular character, I think, has a really proud tradition, actually, of really good actors playing him. And I think I'm really happy to be a part of it.
So if you're just joining us, my guest is Edward Norton, and he co-stars in the new film Birdman. I want to ask you about your work in Wes Anderson's films. You were one of the stars of Moonrise Kingdom and were in Grand Budapest Hotel. Wes Anderson's films walk this really interesting line between comedy and deep emotion. I usually find myself like smiling through most of his films, and by the end I'm in tears because they work on a very deep emotional level. What does he tell you about the tone he wants from you as an actor? And let's use Moonrise Kingdom as an example. And in Moonrise Kingdom, you're playing a scout master, and they're called the Khaki Scouts, but it's the equivalent of the Boy Scouts.
Yeah. Scoutmaster Randy Ward, to be precise.
Yes.
Everything you just said, I agree with. It's exactly what I've loved about Wes from the get-go, the sort of the whimsy and the incredible humor and everything. But there's always these moments of, like, pathos that come in and sideswipe you. And every time I watch The Royal Tenenbaums, I'm laughing and laughing. And then for whatever reason, as soon as there's that scene where he releases the falcon or the hawk over the city and they play that Velvet Underground song, I tear up every single time I watch the movie at that point. And I think it's – I can't explain it. I think, you know, I've come to think that a lot of Wes's movies are about the same thing, which is maybe people struggling with the way that the family that you're born into fails you, or you don't have the family that you sort of want. And so you go and create the family that you need. You know, so many of the characters in Wes's movies are essentially creating alternative communities that support them. And I think there's something really sweet in that idea. And I certainly felt like that was part of, you know, what was in Moonrise Kingdom and Grand Budapest.
Let's hear a scene from Moonrise Kingdom. And you're the scoutmaster at the Boy Scout-type summer camp. And you've just opened up one of the tents and realize one of the boys is missing. So you're organizing a search party with the boys in your scout troop.
You have your orders. Use the orienteering and pathfinding skills that you've been practicing all summer. Let's find our man, bring him safely back to camp. Remember, this isn't just a search party. It's a chance to do some first-class scouting. Any questions? Lazy Eye.
What's your real job, sir?
I'm a math teacher. What?
What grade?
Eighth.
You need a PhD for that?
Lazy Eye, no. But you know what? We're actually in the middle of something here, in case you didn't notice. One of our scouts is missing, and that's a crisis. Anybody else? Redford.
What if he resists?
Who?
Shukoski. Are we allowed to use force on him?
No, you're not. This is a nonviolent rescue operation. Your mission is to find him, not to hurt him under any circumstances. Am I making myself understood?
Yes.
Good. I'm going to change my answer, in fact. This is my real job. Scoutmaster, Troop 55. A math teacher on the side.
So great. And
I think my favorite, like, people talk about how meticulous Wes is, mm-hmm. and how little room for improvisation, but he walked up to me about three takes into that sequence and said to me and the kid, he comes up to the kid, he said, you know what? Add one more question. Ask him if you need a PhD for that. Like, I walked away and laughed for 15 minutes and had to come back and do it, because every time I hear it now, I'm so happy he put that in the last minute. It cracks me up.
Well, and I love too that this whole sequence is done as if it were like a war movie, where, like, you're the general and, like, you rescue, you know, you eventually rescue this or try to rescue this boy, and then you rescue your superior who didn't have faith in you, but, you know, you rescue him from a situation. But it's all on such this, like, small children's scale.
Yeah, although there's nothing small or children's scale about Harvey Keitel. He weighs like 240.
And you had to carry him out.
And he's got a density of muscle that you've never seen in a man that age, and carrying him on your back is...
Did you have the muscles to carry him out?
Anything but childlike. You know what? I'll admit this on the air. I don't think I ever have, but he's so heavy that not only the idea of jumping, but even running with him was so ludicrous that they had to build me a Harvey Keitel backpack dummy that had made of foam, that had straps on the chest, so that I could wear it and run with him, because it... Three union grips couldn't carry Harvey, let alone one, you know, 155-pound actor.
That's hysterical. I'd like to see that. I want to play a scene from another movie that you made. And this, I think this has become something of a cult film. It's called Death to Smoochie. I don't think it did that well at the box office, but I just think it's a wonderful film and worth checking out if you haven't seen it. It's from 2002. And in this, you play a character whose calling is being a children's TV character dressing as a rhino in a pink rhino suit. It's kind of like a Big Bird character, except it's a rhino. And you're so committed to, like, to this character and the good it can bring in the world, but you're not on TV and nobody wants you. So, like, to earn a living at this point in the film, one of the things you're doing is performing, you know, singing and playing guitar at a methadone clinic. So, like,
in Coney Island.
In Coney Island, yeah. So you're performing and everybody's basically in a deep nod as you're singing. So I want to play you singing in the methadone clinic in your pink rhino costume.
Thanks a lot, fellas.
Ladies?
Yeah. Looking at the faces here, I think it might be getting time to wrap things up. So I'm going to close it out with a little ditty. You may recognize the tune, but I've taken a few liberties with the lyrics. If you figure out the chorus, come on and join on in, okay? Oh, we'll get you off that snackle, yes, we will. Oh, we'll get you off that snackle, yes, we will. Oh, we're gonna get you off that smack. We'll kick that monkey right off your back and get your life on track. Oh, yes, we will. It's important to get started now, though. You know why? 'Cause the smack can lead to crack. Oh, yes, it can. Carl, you know what I'm talking about, brother.
Sing it with me now.
Giving up that smack.
I just always laugh every time I hear that. Did you have anything to do with writing the song?
Probably one of the proudest things in my career is the occasional $40 check I get for residuals for lyrics and music on Death to Smoochie, which I really proudly share with Adam Resnick, who is the madcap genius who wrote Death to Smoochie and wrote many of those songs, like Your Stepdad's Not Me and He's Just Adjusting and others. I ended up sort of kind of putting the musical underpinnings and embellishing on them. But sharing those music royalties with Adam is definitely a highlight of my career.
I want to play a clip from a 2002 film that you made, directed by Spike Lee, called The 25th Hour. It's adapted from a novel, and in this film you play Monty Brogan, a drug dealer, who was caught by the DEA, and you're about to begin a 7-year prison sentence. And the film follows you during the last day before you have to report to the prison. In this scene, you're visiting your father, played by Brian Cox, at the bar that he owns and runs.
I talked to Sal.
Dad, come on.
Let's see if you can help with that.
Dad, guy's been out of the picture for 20 years.
He still knows people.
Look, that's not the point. I don't want you to get involved. Okay? I mean it. I'm going to be all right.
You know, you'll still be a young man when you get out. I know you don't think about it, but don't start any trouble in there. Keep your head
Dad,
down.
Don't worry about me, please.
This should never have happened. You could have been, if you wanted money, you could have done anything you wanted. Doctor, lawyer.
Don't lay that on me.
That's all I'm saying.
Don't lay that on me. I mean, when Sal and his crew were squeezing you for the payments, I didn't hear you wishing I was a law school student then. Not one word from you back then. Where'd you think that money was coming from? Donald Trump?
That was a mistake.
Well, let's just forget it then.
There were lots of mistakes. I should have stopped drinking when your mother passed.
Oh, please. Please don't do this.
11-year-old boy with a dead mother and a drunk father.
Okay, you know.
I got no one to blame but myself.
Oh, stop. It wasn't you, Bob.
It's my guest, Edward Norton, with Brian Cox in a scene from The 25th Hour. Is it interesting for you to hear that scene played back with the music after you've filmed it?
Yeah, very. It's crazy what hearing something that you did does to your sort of memory synapses. Brian's voice is so distinctive. It's such a trigger on, you know, I can actually, it just sort of throws you to a period of work and a lot of details, and it's really interesting. It's really interesting to hear it and not see it too.
There's a scene in The 25th Hour that's kind of an homage to Taxi Driver. And I'm wondering if that was very influential, that film was very influential for you and for Spike Lee.
That's funny. I've never heard that referenced. I totally get why, because of the mirror
exactly
element,
and also the taxis driving by and the kind of slow motion people staring at the screen
and
saying nasty things, like when Travis is driving by Times Square in his taxi.
Yeah, you know what? That's totally interesting, and I wouldn't be surprised at all if Spike, if that, it didn't occur to me at the time, but only for this reason, which is The 25th Hour was a novel written by David Benioff, who adapted his own novel into the screenplay. David, many people know because he's the creator of the Game of Thrones, creator and writer of the Game of Thrones series, which is so hugely popular now. But it was his novella that he adapted. And the crazy thing was that entire monologue was in the novel. It's this big aria in the novel of the character talking to himself and saying all those things. And when David adapted his own book into the screenplay, he cut it out. And both Spike and I had separately, you know, put a highlighter around it and said, "How, you know, why isn't this in there? It's one of the greatest things in there." And we were with David and we kind of said, like, how can you cut out that mirror monologue? And he said, well, I didn't think it was cinematic enough. And Spike, I remember Spike going, yeah, you leave that to me. He was like, that's my job.
Edward Norton co-stars in the new film Birdman. You'll find a longer version of his conversation with Terry Gross online at freshair.npr.org. Some older TV series, including The Wonder Years and WKRP in Cincinnati, are being released on DVD this month. Our TV critic David Bianculli has been waiting a long time for them and has been thinking about why they're being released now.
At the moment, we're at yet another pivot point in the history of home entertainment, which keeps changing with sudden and major tectonic shifts. Just ask Blockbuster Video. Video cassettes for home libraries gave way to DVDs, which now seem to be giving way to streaming video and the cloud. Today's young consumers don't seem to want to possess physical copies of their favorite TV shows. They just want access to them wherever they can find them. So in what may be a last gasp for DVD collections, some of the new box set releases are aimed at baby boomers and Gen Xers, and are lavished with the kinds of extras and extra care that make a strong argument for purchasing them. The perfect example of this is Star Vista and Time Life's new set of The Wonder Years, the ABC sitcom that ran from 1988 to 1994. A really bad, misleadingly named single DVD called The Best of The Wonder Years was released 10 years after the series premiered, back in 1998. But there's been nothing since, even though The Wonder Years is one of the most requested titles by DVD collectors. That's because the musical elements were a seminal part of that series, to set both the time and the mood. And the music rights for home video release proved too complicated and expensive to acquire. But recent DVD releases of Freaks and Geeks, Veronica Mars, and other series have proven that fans will pay extra for the original music. So this new Wonder Years set has acquired most of it. Not all, but the vast majority. And more than 100 of the 115 episodes are presented with all of the songs intact. That's fabulous news. And the even more fabulous news is that the Wonder Years holds up so beautifully in every way. It stars Fred Savage as Kevin Arnold, a teenager coming of age in the late 60s, and looking back on his life 20 years later in narration provided by Daniel Stern. Another 20 years have gone by since the series ended. Fred Savage is old enough now to record his own middle-aged narration for the show. But The Wonder Years hasn't dated at all. The music, the tone, the message, the nostalgia, everything remains pitch perfect, as in these closing moments from the pilot episode, when Kevin comforts and kisses his neighbor, Winnie Cooper, as the music swells and the voice of the adult Kevin puts it all in perspective.
It was the first kiss for both of us. We never really talked about it afterward. But I think about the events of that day again and again, and somehow I know that Winnie does too. Whenever some blowhard starts talking about the anonymity of the suburbs, the mindlessness of the TV generation. because we know that inside each one of those identical boxes, with its Dodge parked out front and its white bread on the table and its TV set glowing blue in the falling dusk, there were people with stories. There were families bound together in the pain and the struggle of love. There were moments that made us cry with laughter. And there were moments, like that one, of sorrow and wonder.
The Wonder Years set includes lots of extras and comes packaged in a miniature school locker with loads of goodies. But for me, the episodes are what matter. And it matters that they're presented so lovingly and so relatively complete. Music rights also are at the heart of another new release this month, Shout Factory's WKRP in Cincinnati, the complete series. Only the first season of this sitcom, which originally ran on CBS from 1978 to 1982, was released on DVD. And that was back in 2004, with much of its original music replaced. As with the Wonder Years, this new collection contains most but not all of the original music. But unlike the Wonder Years, which holds up superbly, WKRP in Cincinnati plays as a more dated viewing experience. But for those who remember it and liked it, it's still an enjoyable one. My favorite moment of all, based on an actual very unfortunate radio promotion, had WKRP newsman Les Nessman reporting on a Thanksgiving Day stunt in which a station helicopter flew over a crowd and released a bunch of live turkeys, who, it turned out, couldn't fly. The live radio report by Nessman, played by Richard Sanders, was a disaster, just like the one involving the Hindenburg back in the 20s.
What a sight, ladies and gentlemen, what a sight. The copter seems to be circling the parking area now. I guess it's looking for a place to land. No, something just came out of the back of the helicopter. It's a dark object. Perhaps a skydiver plummeting to the earth from only 2,000 feet into the air. Second to the third. There's no parachutes yet.
I can't tell just yet what they are, but... Oh, my God, they're turkeys! Oh, Johnny, can you get this? Oh, they're crashing to the earth right in front of my eyes! One just went through the windshield of a parked car! Johnny, this is terrible. The
brothers running around pushing each other? Oh, my goodness! Oh, the humanity!
Finally, also appearing this month on DVD, also from Shout Factory, is the complete series Pee-wee's Playhouse. This series was released on DVD 10 years ago, but now it's remastered and available for the first time on Blu-ray. Many TV series don't benefit much from the enhanced sound and visuals of Blu-ray, but some do. Pushing Daisies, Twin Peaks, Breaking Bad, and yes, Pee-wee's Playhouse, with Paul Reubens and his endlessly inventive take on a children's TV show. On radio, I can't show you the brilliance of the visual restoration, but I can play us out with a theme song, which should remind you of the show's manic, infectious energy. If you're going to sing along, sing real loud.
David B. Ancooley is founder and editor of the website TV Worth Watching and teaches TV and film history at Rowan University in New Jersey. Coming up, we'll get tips about cooking meat and poultry from Jack Bishop and Bridget Lancaster of America's Test Kitchen. This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm Dave Davies in for Terry Gross. We're going to listen to the interview Terry recently recorded with Jack Bishop and Bridget Lancaster of America's Test Kitchen. Bishop and Lancaster worked on the new book, The Cook's Illustrated Meat Book. It's about how to shop for, store, season, and cook meat and poultry, and how to prevent contaminating your kitchen with bacteria from the raw meat. Bishop is the editorial director of America's Test Kitchen and edited the new meat cookbook. Lancaster is executive food editor of the Test Kitchen and contributed to the book.
Bridget Lancaster, Jack Bishop, welcome back to Fresh Air. It's always a treat to have you on the show. So let's start with shopping for meat. When you're shopping for beef, some cows are fed with grass, some cows are fed with grains. Are you better off shopping for grass, for meat from grass-fed cows?
Well, this is kind of interesting because I think most people would say that grass-fed certainly commands a higher price. You see it on a lot of restaurant menus. It's supposed to have a bit more gamey flavor, kind of more old-fashioned beef flavor, which is what we were thinking when we did a taste test in the kitchen. And we actually cooked a number of different cuts that were both grain-fed and grass-fed and then did a blind taste test. And the reality is we had a hard time telling the difference. There may be reasons that you want to have grass-fed because you like the way that, you know, the farming practices in terms of the way they're using the land and grazing. But the differences there were much more sort of minor than you would think, given the hype about grass-fed beef.
You know, you always hear that cows were designed to eat grass and chew their cud as opposed to grains, which their digestive systems aren't really designed to digest.
Yeah, I like to think that, you know, if I were a cow, I'd rather be out on a free range eating grass than in a pen eating grain, which that may be the reason to be getting the grass fed. But, you know, if you really don't know what you're eating in a side-by-side taste test, it's really pretty subtle. And most people are not going to be able to tell the difference.
I got to ask, since America's Test Kitchen recently came out with a gluten-free cookbook, if you're eating an animal that was fed grains and there were glutinous grains, is the animal's meat gluten-free?
The meat is still gluten-free.
Okay.
Yeah.
Thank you for selling that. Have you been asked that before?
No, that's the first time, Terry. Good question.
But that is a great question.
But you're confident that that's the right answer?
Yeah, because gluten is a protein that's in flour, and there's no gluten in, you know, meat protein. You know, the only issue would be some sort of cross-contamination issue in the sense that, you know, the meat has somehow been dusted with grain in some way. But, you know, that's not really an issue given how far removed the meat at the supermarket is from, you know, the grain at the farm.
Okay, let's continue with labeling of meat. If it says free range, what does that actually translate to?
Oh, free range chickens. Well, The whole idea is that the chickens are allowed to go and run free out in the graze out in the pasture, but really free range can be a little bit a bit of a misnomer. Often they're inside free range, so they don't have outside access. So really, when you see free range or even pasture raised, that doesn't necessarily mean that the hens and the chickens are out roaming free and having a party outside. They're often inside. So unless you visit the chicken farm, you almost don't know how the chickens are being raised.
So what do you look for on the labels when you're buying chicken?
I still look for pasture raised or free range. There are some companies that are known to treat their chickens very well. Bell and Evans is one. And just knowing what to look for, of course, you can always ask the butcher behind the counter. I know that some supermarkets will have literature now on the local farms that they sell the meat from. So that's always a good idea.
You know, the problem is even if the animal, the chicken, has access to the free range, you really don't know, were they inside for 99.9% of their life or were they outside? I think that whether it's water chilled or air chilled is actually a much bigger difference. So after the after the chicken has been plucked, in the processing, they need to chill the bird, and they can either do it by putting it in a very cold water or put it in a very cold refrigerated area. And if they do it in the water, the bird picks up a lot of water weight, 5 to 10% additional water weight. And so in addition to paying for a lot of water, which doesn't seem like the very good deal, that water kind of washes out the flavor and it's very bland. And so one of the things that we recommend in the test kitchen is that you look for an air-chilled bird rather than a water-chilled. And if you read the labels carefully, you can see those words on there.
Okay. And also, look, getting back to beef for a second, you suggest not buying select beef, but choosing choice or prime. What do those labels even mean?
Well, choice, prime, select, and then there are a few down the food chain that usually aren't sold in supermarkets. It's basically grading the beef. So it's the amount of fat, the amount of marbling, the intramuscular tissue. And that's really important because you want, especially cuts of beef, pork even, you want often to have that intramuscular fat as it cooks. The meat will stay nice and moist, and it also helps tenderize it because it contains a lot of gelatin, or it contains a lot of collagen that converts to gelatin, which is what makes that meat so nice and tender.
So let's get to actually cooking. First of all, one of the myths you try to destroy in the book is that searing seals in the juices. Apparently, that's not true. Why do people think it's true, but it's actually not?
Well, I think people think it's true because when you're searing meat, you're kind of tightening the exterior. So if you think of it that way, it's almost people have often thought, and I thought originally, that it was trapping that juice inside. But actually, the opposite is happening. Anytime that you introduce poultry or meat to really high heat, whether it's a very hot oven or right on the stovetop, that contraction of the meat fibers are squeezing out liquid. So the higher the heat, the faster this happens. So it actually, in theory and in practice, does do the very opposite. It will, if you sear something over high heat, you'll have a much drier piece of meat or poultry than if you cook it at a more moderate temperature.
So give us an example of a recipe in which you do pan sear the meat and tell us how you would do it.
Well, one of my favorite recipes from this cookbook is it's our thick-cut steaks, which are pan-seared. And traditionally, the recipe would say something like sear the steaks over high heat and then finish in a moderate oven. Moderate oven's about 300, 325, even 350. And that's how we've traditionally done steaks in the past. But we looked at what we were saying, that searing meat, especially first, robs the meat of juices. But what we did was we turned things around. So we start the steaks, and they have to be really thick steaks for this to work. We start them in a pretty low oven, 275, until they reach about 90, 95 degrees. Of course, they're not done at that point. But during the time in the oven, the exterior of the steaks get nice and dry so that when we go to finally sear them on the stovetop over really, really high heat, just a couple minutes aside, then they're really dry. They have a nice crisp crust on the outside. Plus, if you've ever seared a steak or a pork chop, anything like that, you'll often get this band of overcooked meat right around the exterior of the meat before the interior is cooked to your preferred doneness. So this completely eliminates it. It brings the entire steak up to a certain temperature, 90 to 95 degrees, and then it sears the steak. We sear the steak on the stovetop to get that really good crust. So the steak is not having to spend as much time on the stovetop getting really, really tight, squeezing out meat. And we found a huge difference between this method and the traditional method and the amount of juices that were left in steaks. And especially these days, if you are buying premium steak, you want to make sure that you cook it to perfection because beef is really expensive these days.
Let's talk about making a good hamburger. Why don't you give us your favorite recipe? And I just want to say about this that you suggest, I remember when my mother was making hamburgers, she'd like, you know, pat them and pat them a lot. And you have this like hands-off approach. You like to touch the meat as little as possible. Why?
Well, every time you touch, grind, move, look at ground meat, it starts to release a protein that's really, really sticky called myosin. So the more that you pack it or damage, basically when you grind beef, you're damaging the meat fibers. So the more you damage it or touch it or pack it, the more of that sticky protein is going to be formed. And a sticky protein sometimes might not be a bad thing, for instance, for something like a meatloaf where you want a bit more cohesion. But for a burger where you're going to bite into it, you want it to almost just hang together. So our approach does, we start off with grinding our meat. So we do use the sirloin, their steak tips, so you get that really beefy flavor and a good amount of fat. But our secret is a little bit of short rib meat, which is much fattier and richer. So these are kind of the ultimate burgers. So we grind that, and you have to be really careful not to overgrind it. So we cut the beef into small pieces. And then we, instead of using a meat grinder, you actually don't need one at home. You can use your food processor. We grind it in batches, just pulsing the food processor until the pieces of meat are relatively small. After you grind that in batches, then that's where your hands-off approach really comes into play. You spread the meat out on a rimmed baking sheet, and you want to look for any pieces of fat that really didn't grind well or connective tissue. It's your opportunity to be as choosy about the meat that you're about to eat as you want. So after that, we kind of bundle the meat into mounds and then very gently pack the meat into patties. And by pack, I really mean it's almost a hands-off. It's like you're cradling a newborn baby almost. You have to be very, very gentle with it. And the best part of that is the surface of the burger itself is not completely smooth. It's got all these crags and crevices in it. So when you go to cook it, you're going to have a really nice crust that forms on the sides of the beef.
Okay, so you've put together the perfect burger. How are you going to cook it?
So we're going to cook the burgers in a skillet. They're really, really tender. So we have another recipe that's very similar that will go out on the grill, but these are way too tender to go on the grill. They will just fall in between the grates of the grill. So we want to start these on a really, really high heat. And remember, we're going to cook these until they're medium. But before you cook it, you want to refrigerate the patties because that's going to help them to set up and be a little bit less fragile before they go into the pan. So they go into a really, really hot skillet. It's a dry skillet. You add oil to the skillet, and you want to heat that oil until it's just smoking. That's really key. A lot of people will start burgers or any meat into a pan that's not hot enough, and so you're not going to get that sear, that bit of smoke that's going to char the outside. So you want to start that in a really, really hot skillet and cook it. Put them right into the skillet. Don't move them for about 3 minutes.
Why not?
If you do move them at the very start, the burgers are sticking to the pan. So this is not a nonstick pan. This is a regular pan because we want to develop more crust. And a nonstick pan tends to not develop as much crust on the burgers. So you put them right into the preheated skillet that has a little bit of oil in it and leave them alone 3 minutes. After 3 minutes, they will start to release themselves from the pan because on the underside, they're starting to steam a little bit. So that helps the burgers to release from the pan. So you have to take a spatula, a really nice wide spatula that's going to hold the entire burger, and flip it over. And it's about another minute on the second side before you can put cheese on it, and then another minute. And then the burgers are ready to eat. Of course, it's always a good idea to toast the buns right in the skillet as well.
Do you have any favorite meat or poultry dishes from your childhood that are considered old-fashioned now but that you really love to prepare?
Oh, I have one that comes to mind. My mother, whenever we would have a bad day, my mother would always make. I love this still to this day. She'd take chicken breasts and salt and pepper them, and dip them in butter, and then in cracker crumbs, and bake them. And as simple and easy as that sounds, that was one of our favorite meals growing up. And of course, us kids would try to eat all of the cracker bits that came out, the buttery cracker bits that came out of the oven that were all toasty. That's definitely one. The other one, pot roast. Pot roast definitely meant it was Sunday because that thing took forever to cook. And, the meat was just fall apart. The broth from the pot roast, we would spoon that over roasted potatoes or mashed potatoes. And it's just really good comfort food. I think that's what these large roasts, a whole chicken, turkey, hams, they kind of, to me, almost speak of a family table or an old-fashioned time where the food took time and then you sat at the table and you took time to eat it as well.
Jack, what about you? Do you have favorite meat or poultry recipes from your childhood that might seem a little old-fashioned now but that you love?
When I was a kid, nothing would make me happier than fried chicken. And I got to say, I haven't grown up and lost that taste for fried chicken. And so there is nothing like chicken that you fry yourself at home. It's really very, very simple. You know, we brine the chicken in a little bit of buttermilk that's been spiked with some salt. And then, you know, it improves the juiciness and the flavor. And then we put it in a rub that's got flour, a little bit of baking powder, which is something that my mother didn't do, but really improves the lift and you get sort of a really crunchy crust. And then we add a little bit of buttermilk to that flour rub. So rather than being a fully dry rub, it's kind of like a shaggy bits. And those shaggy bits fry up into the really big, crunchy exterior. We do it in a Dutch oven in the test kitchen rather than a cast iron skillet. It kind of minimizes the mess. There's less splattering on the cooktop. And we actually use the lid on the Dutch oven for the first half of the cooking time, which helps the oil temperature to recover more quickly. So it prevents greasiness. Greasy chicken means that your oil wasn't at the proper temperature. It was too cool. And so putting the lid on the pot when you put the chicken in, at least for the first half of the cooking time, helps that temperature climb back up and ensures that you don't get greasy chicken, but you get absolutely crispy, crunchy fried chicken.
And I remember when we developed this recipe and that finding of adding buttermilk to the flour mixture to create that really kind of those pieces before they went on the chicken, that was an accident. When we were just dipping the chicken into a flour mixture, we always found that the first few pieces that went into the oil, you know, they had that smooth crust, still really good, but a smooth crust. But it was the last pieces, because after you dipped the chicken in the buttermilk and you dipped it into the flour mixture, it started to get these little bits. And those were the pieces that everybody went for because they were super crunchy and really substantial. And that's a good example of an accident, a happy accident in the test kitchen.
Bridget Lancaster contributed to The Cook's Illustrated Meat Book. Jack Bishop is the book's editor. They both work at America's Test Kitchen. On our website, you'll find a much longer version of their conversation with Terry, as well as their recipes for old-fashioned burgers, buttermilk mashed potatoes, and oven-fried bacon. Fresh Air Weekend was produced by John Myers. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Adam Staniszewski. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Roberta Shorrock, Anne-Marie Baldonado, Sam Brigger, Lauren Krenzel, John Sheehan, Heidi Simon, and Teresa Madden. Our administrative assistant is Dorothy Farabee. Molly C.V. Nesper is our associate producer for online media. For Terry Gross, I'm Dave Davies.